So the Apostles' Creed, working our way through from today. Today's an introductory sermon on the Creed, just about faith. Taking the first two words, I believe. And this creed that we confess together, we normally say it once a month, whenever we also share communion together, the Lord's Supper. And I want to ask, first of all, why? Why do we do it? Why have a creed at all? When we went camping last year, I got the maps out and I studied the route and I planned it. And what I relied on was a really detailed map. But at the same time, I found it very useful to simply highlight the key points, the main points along the way. And one of my old teachers at college, J.I. Packer, he says this: if life is a journey, then the million word long Holy Bible is the large scale map with everything in it. And the 100 word Apostles' Creed is the simplified roadmap, ignoring much but enabling you to see at a glance the main points of the Christian belief. Creed simply means belief. The Latin word credo means I believe. And if someone wants to look into Christianity, if they want to understand what the Christian faith is, then it helps, of course, to have a summary. Everyone believes something, but the question is, what do you believe? In a world full of competing ideas, the early Christians saw the value of spelling it out, what they believe. It was this, and it was not that. In the second century, when the creed first appeared, there were a lot of other non-Christian beliefs going around. Of course, there always are opposite beliefs. And these were in direct opposition to the Christian faith. So it matters for us to say, this is what we believe and not that. And by the way, it's called the Apostles' Creed not because the apostles wrote it, because they did not, but because it teaches apostolic doctrine. It first appeared in the second century. If we're going to keep the faith, then needless to say, we need to know what it is and what it's not. A creed becomes a unifying thing for those who believe it, but at the same time, it's also a way of separating from certain beliefs. Now, I guess that is why some people don't care much for creeds. You know, maybe you think, you know, why do we have to draw lines? You know, do we have to do that? Why do we have to say this and not that? It seems divisive. I thought I'd share with you. I went to the annual meeting of the Society of Friends recently in Dublin, the Quakers, and I was the Presbyterian representative guest. And it was a good day. I very much enjoyed it. It was just around Easter time. I really enjoyed it. And I met some great people. But I was very struck by one particular conversation with a member of the Society of Friends. I asked the question. I said, am I right in saying that you don't have a confession of faith? And the reply came immediately, yes, and that's one of our great strengths. And I was really interested in this. So I asked the person, well, out of interest, what do you have to believe in order to become a member? Now, this may not be terribly representative. I'm sure if I ask enough other people, I might have got some different answers. And I understand that the Quakers, for what it's worth, they vary greatly from place to place. Perhaps we might say the same about Presbyterians. But they said, well, we've got some core values. And then they gave me three. One value was the equality of all human beings. That's really important to us, they said. And I thought, well, that's great. That's right there in Genesis chapter 1. Another core value was peacemaking. We believe in peacemaking, this person said. And again, I thought, well, that's great. Who's going to argue with that? And the third core value they mentioned was living simply, not getting caught up in materialistic things. And once again, I thought, well, that is a good thing. And it was interesting that even though they did not have a confession of faith, they nevertheless could not get away from having some unifying beliefs, some set of beliefs that for them matter most, some set of beliefs that really get at the heart of who they are and what they're about. In a way, a creed or a confession is simply being open and honest about what that is and being very transparent about that. As the conversation went on, I discovered that for this person, and again, it varies a lot, but for this person, becoming a member required that they embrace passivism, but not a belief that Jesus was the Son of God. The identity of Jesus was really not important for this particular member, and apparently it was not an issue at all for those who received this particular person into fellowship. And that just highlighted to me why creeds are so vitally important. In Matthew chapter 16, we read of Jesus asking his disciples, "Who do people say I am?" And they reply, "Well, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" Jesus asked. "Who do you say I am?" And of course, Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then Jesus said, "On this rock I will build my church." Peter's confession of who Jesus is was the rock, and it was the very foundation upon which Jesus would build his church. And we need to understand today that Christianity is a creedal faith, and that it stands on the foundation of this confession that Peter made of the identity of Jesus. In the New Testament, Jesus exhorted his disciples not only to believe his teachings and to follow him and believe in him, but also exhorted them to confess him before men. And he said, let me just read from Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse 32 says, "Whoever acknowledges me before men," Jesus said, "I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven." We're also told in the reading that we had from Romans 10 that if we believe with our hearts and confess with our lips that Jesus is Lord, then we shall be saved. So we have a mandate. We have a mandate not only to possess faith, but also to make an outward verbal confession of that faith, to proclaim what it is we believe. And that may come at great cost. When the early Christians professed that Jesus is Lord, which by the way is the earliest Christian creed that there was, found in the New Testament, Jesus is Lord. When the early Christians made that profession, it was in direct response to the requirement in the Roman Empire to profess that Caesar is Lord. And the Bishop of Smyrna at the time, a man named Polycarp, was arrested and sent into the amphitheatre to be martyred because he would not confess that Caesar is Lord, but maintained that Jesus is Lord. He repeated that creed in obedience to Jesus. As time passed, the church increased her confession to make several other critical affirmations about the faith. And as I said, the Apostles' Creed is 100 words. And while all Christians believe more than what is contained in the Apostles' Creed, none can believe less and call themselves Christian. None can believe less and call themselves Christian. It's a powerful thing to know that when we confess the Apostles' Creed, we're declaring the very words that gave those early Christians hope, that sent martyrs confidently to their deaths, and have instructed Christ's church throughout the centuries. So we've thought about why we have a creed, to make known and to clarify the faith, what we unite on, what our hope is, what we're willing to live and die for in obedience to Christ. Let's think now about what kind of faith we are to have as Christians. The very nature of biblical faith is often misunderstood and misrepresented. The evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins has said that religious faith is based on no evidence at all. He made that extraordinary claim in a little YouTube video on the subject of faith. He sees religious faith as an irrational, blind leap in the dark, demanding allegiance that is simply an act of the will, regardless of any rational basis. That is his caricature of what faith is. Don't ask any questions, just believe. You know, you just got to make a decision to trust, decide to take a leap in the dark and begin to live on the basis of your faith. But that's not biblical faith, that's superstition. And yet it's an idea that I think has crept into a lot of people's thinking. The very word faith is often said in contrast to in contrast with science and reason. And that's a real mistake. I mean, the thing is that even if we tried to just decide as an act of will to believe something without any rational basis, it doesn't even work anyway. I mean, you can't simply decide to believe something that you don't really believe. Yeah, it just doesn't work. The Scottish philosopher David Hume pointed that out. He did a critical analysis of anyone believing anything, and he concluded that a mere act of will is never enough to believe something. Your mind and your heart need plausible reasons to believe something. And in that sense, there's an involuntary dimension to authentic belief. You either believe something or you don't. You can't just turn it on and say, right, I'm going to believe this. I've no idea why, but I'm going to anyway. I mean, you can try maybe to do that, but it doesn't work. It's not even being honest with yourself. And whenever we look at biblical faith, nowhere does the New Testament call us to park our minds or to leave our brains at the door when we come into church. Instead of leaping out into the darkness, we are called to come out of the darkness and into the light, to believe that God has spoken by looking at the evidence. Not that long ago, we were looking at the Gospel of John, and he says, of course, his reason for writing in John chapter 20. He says, these things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So the only faith that John is calling for is faith that is based on compelling evidence. In conclusion, biblical faith is not superstition. It is not irrational. It is addressed first to the mind and then to the heart. That's why the four Gospels are written. That's why the book of Acts has Paul on his missionary journeys, reasoning with people and persuading and explaining and proving. Those are the verbs that are used again and again. It is never an irrational, blind faith. And that's why we spend so much time studying the things of God. It's because God wants us to know and understand who he is and what he's done so that we might love him with all of our hearts and with all of our minds. Now, Augustine said, the heart cannot embrace what the mind rejects. And therefore the word of God is addressed in the first instance to your mind. The late R.C. Sproul, American Presbyterian minister and author, he said, we should seek to have a clear, intelligible, rational understanding to the deepest level that we can achieve it. Not so that we can have a cold, speculative religion, but that our souls may become inflamed by love and affection for what we now understand and embrace. And that brings us on to the most important aspect of the faith that we're called to. Not simply a faith that is well thought through, based on compelling evidence, but also a faith that you believe with all your heart. A passionate commitment that begins to shape your entire life. Christianity teaches the primacy of the heart. Not a mere intellectual assent that we're called to. Yes, there's that cognitive, rational element to faith, but think of what James says in his letter. James says that even the demons believe and tremble. And interestingly, they were the first to recognize the true identity of Jesus in the Gospels. They knew the truth about Christ. But of course, that mere knowledge, that conviction they had about Christ, was not saving faith. They were not trusting Jesus. They had no affection for Jesus. They hated him. And therefore, our belief in Jesus better not be like the demons. We better have more than mere intellectual assent. God calls for a heart commitment. We do well to evaluate that, you know, with regard to ourselves, don't we? I don't know if you ever listened to Jordan Peterson, a Canadian clinical psychologist, is a bit of a, well, he's massive on YouTube. He points out that while we all have beliefs, there might actually be a difference between what we think we believe and what we actually believe, that we're not transparent to ourselves. And it reminded me of a movie, the 1979 or 80 movie called Stalker, in which there are three men on a journey. The destination is shrouded in mystery and intrigue, but eventually we learn that one of the men is leading the other two to a place called the Zone, and more specifically to the room within the Zone. The room is what has drawn them, because in the room they will achieve their heart's desire. In the room their dreams will come true. In the room they will get exactly what they want. And the fascinating thing is that when they get there, they get cold feet. Who wants to go first? Because it dawns on them, well, what if I don't know what I want? I think I know what I want, but what if those are just surface things that don't go very deep? What if I don't know myself very well? Maybe what I say I want and what I think I want isn't actually what I deep down really want. The room will reveal all. Who wants to go first? You know, if true faith is heart commitment, not just intellectual assent, then there might actually be a difference between what we say and think we believe and what we actually believe. As Glenn Scrivener says, whose book we're reading on our men's breakfasts, I can tell myself that I believe in love and groovy vibes and pixie dust, but if my life is full of bitterness and spite and anxiety, then you'd better be right to be suspicious about whether I really do believe what I say I believe. Jesus said, you shall know them by their fruits. And the question is, do our lives demonstrate that heart commitment? Now, when we think about this, I don't know about you, I'm a little bit troubled at first, you know, because we begin to think, well, am I a hypocrite? You know, are we actually hypocrites? I say I believe in God, but sometimes I live as if I don't. So does that mean I don't really believe in God? So here's my final point. We need to realize that faith comes before obedience. And obedience takes time. True belief does not mean that we suddenly live exactly the way we should. True belief does not mean perfect obedience. As Glenn Scrivener has noted, your children trust you first and obey you eventually. Maybe, partially. Faith comes first, obedience comes later, and it is hard won. In John chapter 1, verse 12, it says, to all who received Jesus, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. So, believing in Jesus means receiving Jesus. It doesn't mean that we perfectly obey him all of a sudden and live like him, just, you know, automatically. Does an adopted child instantly share the family nature? No. The change of name happens instantly. The change of nature happens gradually. To confess Jesus, then, is simply to confess our faith that we need him. We need him. And we rely on him for forgiveness and mercy, knowing that we deserve the opposite. Faith comes first, then obedience. May we see our need for Christ today, and may we call out for him in faith with a heart commitment. He stands among us today. And in light of his death and resurrection, he says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Why have a creed? To make known and clarify the faith, what we unite on, what our hope is, what we're willing to live and die for in obedience to Christ. What kind of faith are we to have? One that is well thought through, A credible faith based on compelling evidence that leads to a passionate heart commitment. But remember, faith comes before obedience. May we turn to Christ today in faith, know his mercy, and may we then know his gradual transforming power in our lives, knowing thankfully that God is patient with us, and he will carry on to completion the work that he's begun.